We're going to talk about cross-cultural life now, because the moment you start talking about the story and communicating it across cultures, then you have to talk about the different ways that people hear and contextualize and tell stories. I can tell you that the story of the scripture is just one of the great stories, period, of all time. And yet even my love for the story, my professional, personal, and ecclesial sort of mastery of it does not prevent me from running into constant faux pas and problems associated with telling the story. And this is where this could be, hopefully we can really just, I must control the data enough where we can discuss, because this is the seminar, this is the session of the entire seminar regarding the worship aspect of what I'm talking about. Because worship is essentially a cultural affair, I'm going to argue. It is a divine affair. God Almighty is an actor in our worship. The very presence of the Holy Spirit and Christ himself is present with us when we gather. But the issues of culture really, really make themselves plain when it comes to our life together. Now, there is this sense of always this nagging sense that in a world where all other people are telling various stories with all their own symbol sets, their own canon, their own books, their own storytellers, their own sacred presences, how do we know that our ritual and sacrament, our story, is true? How do we know that even if we know ours is true, how do you know that your particular telling of it is right? Which is a real issue. And this is where culture comes in. It's just, unless you're an unusual human being, you tend to accept your version of the story as a correct version. It's just an ethnocentric reality. You just tend to view who you are as accurate, and your sentiments are correct, your data is sound, your arguments are valid. Your telling of it, your enacting of it, your singing of it is always the best. After all, you're accustomed to who you are. And frankly, the real issue here is that we must understand that as we go forward in really trying to make the story come alive among people, that the differences that we share really make a difference in the way we contextualize and proclaim the story. There is no such thing as a value-free, historically conditioned-free telling of a story. There isn't. Quite honestly, Jesus did not think and speak in English. Anyone who's done any translation, if you've taken any exegetical classes of any kind, you know the difficulty that we run into when we're trying to make sense of the text. Depending on your read, your nuance, what you want to emphasize, what you don't. It's in a different language, at a different time, in a different place. And overcoming that distance, not only with the ancients, where our story actually began and the key events of our story took place, but not only sort of decoding that story, but encoding it for the people that we're with. And I'm just saying, not being aware of that process is going to ruin your ability to tell the story outside of the people who are like you. It's fine if you are willing to stay around people just like you, because they know you, they hear you, they're accustomed to you. But once you step out and begin to translate the story to others, then it becomes a problem. I like what Paul Hebert says. By the way, I think that a good component to be added, if it's not already here at the Institute of Worship Studies, is some good missiological anthropology. Because in that field, there is a relativization of who we are. Everyone has to sort of, we all begin flat. See, your culture is not better than mine. Your understanding and nuance is not better than mine. So we can, frankly, we can begin to think about theology, worship, spiritual formation in brand new ways. I'll never forget Mark Noel, who was one of my professors at Wheaton, a brilliant man, written 60, 70 books on Christian history. Brilliant. Excellent person now, chair of history at Notre Dame, one of esteemed chair, survey of the church course, and he's giving the introduction and the syllabus, and my hand shot up. I was a good student. You know, I wrote, by the way, a shadow syllabus. You know, we should have started a league, the League of Shadow Syllabi. I would create my own syllabus. I got my own questions. You don't tell me my questions. I got my own questions. So I wrote it down. And one of the questions in my syllabus, shadow syllabus, is, are we going to be, it's a history of the church course, are we going to be talking about the church in India, in Africa? Is this a history of European experience church or the church? You know, you give a professor one of those looks like, I can't wait till you make a mistake so I can show my ignorance in my next reply. You know. He was so gracious and so brilliant and so kind that he knew exactly what I was getting at. He said, no, Don, you're right. Properly speaking, this will be a history of largely the European church. Now, guys, I'm just telling you, if you think that your experience in the church is the definitive view of the church in any way, confession, worship, spiritual formation, or witness, then you have another thing coming. And if you cannot embrace your place in the relative sea of God's panoply of people, then quite honestly, it's going to be very, very difficult. God probably won't call you to traverse cultures and barriers to really speak the story in new ways to people who are unlike you. You must be able to relativize your own experience enough to distinguish between theology with a big T and theology with a little T, as Paul Hewitt says. Look at page 45. I'll speed up this thing. Theology is a systematic description and explanation of the way things really are, the way God sees them. And we will speak of this as theology with a capital T. At other times, we will use the term when we speak of human descriptions and explanations of reality that arise out of our study of the Bible. We will speak of this as theology with a small T. Too often, we confuse the two. We think that our studies of the Bible are unbiased and that our own interpretations of the scriptures are the only true ones. It disturbs us, therefore, when we begin to discover that theologies are influenced by culture. The very fact that we phrase our theology in English can prejudice our understanding of the Bible. There is no theologically unbiased language. The fact is, all theologies developed by human beings are shaped by their particular historical and cultural context, by the language they use and the questions they ask. All human theologies are only partial understandings of theology, with a capital T, as God sees. We see through a glass darkly, but the fact that we are humans and see through a glass darkly does not mean that we do not see at all. We can read the scriptures and understand it. The central message of the gospel is clear. He only gives us three fingers, but we know where he's coming from. Okay. Creation, sin, and redemption. He left out something. Following. Of these, we can be certain. It is the fine details that we see less clear. This whole session is on the need for us as we tell the story, as we embody methods and models of worship and theology, discipleship, spiritual formation among peoples, that we attune to the issues of culture. Now, I've given you something below that very quickly. It won't take much time, and it's not meant to. It's just call it your understanding of worn-out slang, city slang. It's on page 45. I will ask you on the left side, I'll say the phrase and you match it with the phrase on the right. This is just saying that you can understand English and not know nothing somebody is saying about anything. Somebody came up to you and said, man, your Steve's a mad idiot. What would you say? Your clothes look really sharp, okay? What time is it? This is over. Any old school folk here should get this.
How are you?
Pardon?
I was saying, hello, how are you?
Yeah, how are you doing? What time is it? Then I don't look at your watch and tell them. Somebody asking me that. Don't say, well, it's 11 to 3. No, that's not what they're saying. How about, this is really old. I thought I would pull out of the hat. That was the biz-bazam bomb.
What a wonderful thing.
That was. And you all up in, you are all up in my grill.
You're too concerned with my affairs.
You're too concerned with my affairs. That's completely whack.
I don't agree with that.
I don't agree with that. That last jam was fat.
I really like that song.
I really like that song. I'm kicking you to the curb.
Our relationship is too bad.
Poofy. That is.
I just refuse to discuss this with you.
Actually, Talk to the Hand and Poof You are very similar. Talk to the Hand, these are old. I need to update my slang. You are, you know, I refuse to talk to you any further. I've got mad scrub. I have plenty of money. To hear my daughter and son were part of the black punk emo culture. I don't know if you know that. My children, they took very seriously my teaching about the need for us to go into areas and to make the story come alive in populations that have never heard it and will never be exposed to it. They took that very seriously. And my children are really amazing people. I mean, they're kind of frightening looking. They're all tatted up. They have dreads on. They're wild looking. I mean, honestly, my son who died, some years back was fierce. You know, he had neck collars and he's all, 6'3" with thick dreads and blonde tips. And he was three shows shy of 400 punk shows. And candidly, as a guitarist, his sound checks were louder than anything I've ever played in any place ever. They are a part of a culture that is, they speak English, they're around people, but they're a part of African-American punk culture. Now, how can I allow that as a Christian scholar, pastor, whatever? Culture is what we're going to talk about. If you don't understand culture, you'll be afraid of it or you will limit yourself. Really, we are a part of a world that is really, really different. But we don't believe that we're just being intolerant and unjust. We are not going to change our story. We talked about this last time. We do believe that we actually have God's unfolding drama that culminates in the person of Christ, told in Scripture, made real to us by the Spirit, and the church is the community that subjectively participates in that unfolding drama. So we do believe that we have our own story. It's objectively told, it's objectively responded to. It is. God the Father sent a Son who accomplished salvation, made real to the world through the Spirit by the word of the apostles. And now the church, wherever she meets and in every place, confesses the truth, worships him through reenactment, is formed by its own participation in the story, and proclaims that story to its neighbors and friends. But guys, if you really want to take seriously this story, you have to look at the world the way it is. And quite honestly, if you turn to page 46, we're just gonna hustle. I just want to give you a snapshot of what's going on, frankly, with the world. The world was made up of 100 people. It'd be an interesting place because very few of them would be North American. Although the North Americans who would be under 6 people would own close to 70% of everything the village owned. The vast majority of the world is not, just for time's sake, let me just cut to the very chase. The world is essentially, if the Lord tarries, the world is going to become a conflagration of urban slums. Right now there are about roughly somewhere between, there's no one knows, 111,000, 120,000 non-Christians become urban dwellers every single day. When my dad was born, he died in 1965. When my father was born in 1900, there were only 20 cities in the entire world that had over a million people. There are well over 360. This data needs to be updated. I mean, there are a significant increase in that. I think it's close to 450 cities that now have over a million people. And by the year 2025, they'll be close to 700 with more than one million people. If you think about it, if you just think about this, by the way, this is where, in your own notes, some of the things that are up here and in your notes may not jive. I'm constantly trying to upgrade these statistics, and so I apologize for any problems there are. In 1900, when my dad lived, there were only 20 million people who lived in urban slums. There are about 715 million that are classified as urban slum dwellers. By 2025, 2 billion people will live in urban slums, and the total number of urban dwellers will be over 3 billion. Guys, for the first time in human history, just about a year or so ago, there were more urban dwellers in the world than any other people. We are now more urbanites than any other people on Earth. And frankly, by the time I reach senior retirement age, one out of every 3 people on Earth will be part of the urban poor, and 3/4 of the world's total population will live in cities. Now, this is important largely because when we think of cities, and the reason why I just make this is that it matters to me. I'm a missionary. I am interested in where population is moving. If the Lord tarries, we need to go where the people are and tell the story. If the vast majority of them are urban and poor, then you can believe I'm going to find a way to get to them. That is what we are saying. We can't sort of ignore them, quite honestly. The story is for them. Isn't it amazing that the story of God is very much like water? It goes to the lowest part first, and then it begins to rise. It's for those who are broken and beaten, discouraged and hammered. And frankly, I'm telling you, the world's masses, urban masses, are really suffering. Most of the times when we look at cityscapes, they're beautiful places, Kansas City, Portland. We don't tend to, we're planning, the organization that I'm a part of, our headquarters is in Los Angeles. We're planting churches all throughout the Los Angeles area among unreached poor people. One of the communities we're in is Watts, which was traditionally black, but now it's largely become an immigrant community. These communities, I would suggest, are the most harrowing and most difficult places on earth to make the story come alive. And yet that is precisely why we have to go there. These great Brooklyn projects in the Bronx or Skid Row in L.A., frankly, the Urban Ministry Institute, one of our most robust satellite campuses, is not too far from the Skid Row district of L.A. I am very interested in what we do to really make this work. So we have to more and more, those of us who are really interested in the world, we have to think about making the story come alive in these cities, these hulks, these places that are largely untouched. And we're talking at any given Sunday in America, if you take our 150 top cities, less than 2% of the metropolitan area are in church. Guys, no one goes to church in the metropolitan area. Now, if I were a person really interested in trying to communicate the gospel, I would want to say, and I am that person, I would want to say, how do we make the gospel come alive in places like, I just gave you the 10 top agglomerations some time ago. I think it's changed. Mexico, Sao Paulo, and Tokyo, they sort of go back and forth. Guys, you know there are 9 times as many kids under the age of 16 as in all the Jacksonville area. There are 9 million kids in Mexico City. Do you want a youth minister? I'm just saying that in a world like this, how do we tell the story? This is what this is about, this session. In my judgment, to have an institute that is concerned about worship must be concerned about the world the way it is. Unchurched, unreached, dramatically diverse, and absolutely not a part of what we're doing. Guys, if you think it's virtually impossible for me to think reasonably about the world without referring to its cities, Washington, New York, Seoul, Cairo, Brasilia, Istanbul, Moscow. I love the way cities are now given strategic import on the basis of what they are. Cultural cities, for instance, when you think about human civilization, cultural cities, think of the great cities that are known for their culture. Paris, Oxford, Boston, San Francisco, or the political and administrative giants, Washington, Moscow, New Delhi. They contain governments and their bureaucracies. The industrial cities, noisy blue-collar factory centers, Bombay, Sao Paulo, Chicago, Gary, or the commercial areas. I think of them, you know, where business is done. It used to be that I didn't have to worry about it. All I could be is a good, hard-working person in my factory. No longer. A decision in Hong Kong can determine whether or not I keep my job or my brother is fired. It has nothing to do with how good I am at my job. The world is interconnected and it's big. You know, you think of what takes place in these giant bazaars of the world where goods and services are exchanged. New York, Hong Kong. Symbolic cities, the very name of them, evoke things. Think of how can you hear the name Soweto or Berlin or Belfast or Beirut or Jerusalem? These cities are known by what they symbolize. They're major cities, hard to reach. And then, of course, the primary cities. Cities that take all of these various elements and combine them in sophisticated, monstrous ways. Bangkok, Mexico City, London. Guys, I want to argue that the cities of America are microcosms of the globe. It's a real excellent way for us to field test some of our thinking about the nature of cities. You know, Miami is the de facto capital of Latin America. It's easily one of the most powerful Latin cities ever. It is amazing. The power, the wealth, the importance of Miami, it's hard to describe. By conservative estimates, this is old. About a million, it's probably more than that, over our 2,400-mile border between Mexico and L.A. I don't think this is included in, well, I don't know what's included in your notes. My notes are a little different. Los Angeles, with its 4 million Hispanics, is the largest, second largest Mexican city. Houston is the fastest growing one. Guys, there has never been a city in the history of humankind probably as diverse as Los Angeles. There are more Samoans in L.A. than American Samoa. I mean, it's one of these weird cities. I mean, it is just so diverse that it's changing the way we think of church. It used to be you could build a church on a corner and then in hope that parish members would come into your church. But you build a church now unless you go way out in the suburbs somewhere and people drive way out to go to church. It's going to be very, very difficult for you to be anywhere within even a mid-sized city and not be surrounded by people who are really dramatically unlike you. This is going to wear out our congregations because we are not ahead of the game on this. We don't think in terms of culture at all. We just, since we, you know, if they move in next door, then we have options. We can start a ministry among them. We can bring them in. That doesn't seem easy to do. What are our other options? I'm just saying this is being faced by hundreds and thousands of congregations who are wrestling with worship issues. Then what should our liturgy of service be? When you have a number of people from a different place, and how should we then blend our worship for them? Who should determine what songs are played? Chris Tomlin, come right on in. We'll do you in a Latin, jazz, and other way. We'll just urbanize you, Chris. Well, I bet we can urbanize Chris Tomlin. Mm-hmm. It's going to be hard, but we can try. That's a joke only for jazz folk. Diverse populations make up the American city. Guys, I don't know if you realize how diverse we're talking about. This is a real issue for us. Guys, I can get my driver's license in 23 languages in Los Angeles. 23. I'm talking about difference. And it's not going away. It's coming to a neighborhood near you. It's coming to where you live. So sooner or later, you're going to have to wrestle with this in some way. 91% of LA is unchurched. You know, if 4/5 of all Houston's school kids are Hispanic, Black, or Asian, there are close to 40 cities in America where minorities are the majority of the people in the city. And there are two states, at least, where minorities are the majority in the state. You can name the two. California? No, Texas is still, it's breathing. I think it's Hawaii, I think. I could be wrong, but I think it's, I know for a fact that California is. I mean, you know. Guys, it used to be, all I'm trying to say, and I don't think this, you know, 20 years ago, you could go to New York and you could do a survey and people from every place in mainland China live within a 4-block area. I mean, it's as if the nations have all come here. If I want to minister among the Hmong of Cambodia, I don't have to go to Cambodia. I can go to Fresno. It's got one of the largest Hmong populations on earth. You want to minister among Somalians? Why don't we start a ministry in Minneapolis? Because there are 40,000 of them there. Guys, there are 500,000 Filipinos in San Francisco. I'm just saying, what do we do? Do we say anyone may come and whosoever will may enter? Except when difference comes and we don't know what to do. This is a real issue, y'all. We got to wrestle with this. Now, they're not going away. They're coming. I'm very tempted to stop all of these barrage of statistics and hear what you guys think about this. What do you think are some answers? Just, golly. What do you think are some issues that we need to be aware of with this? How would you solve these issues? By the way, let me be clear before you answer. We cannot consider issues of worship and ignore these issues. You cannot. You cannot. You will be forced to simply go with your own ethnocentric, idiosyncratic tastes. You will only select music and themes that you like. And quite honestly, you will force everyone else to accept everything else that you're doing. You can either respond to me if I'm a part of your church or not. If I'm cool, like myself, you learn to be bicultural. I'm going to talk about biculturalism. I have some models I'd like you guys to look at. A lot of people who are tokens in majority congregations simply cave in to those congregations so that for the keeping of the peace and things like that. No one ever asked them about music. All the years I was there, you guys, Sue, my dear friend from Iowa, they were explicitly, Sue was one of the few worship leaders I ever saw who explicitly tried to include difference of every kind into our regular liturgy. I mean, drums. It was wild. I mean, frankly, it was great. But there were a lot of Africans and others who were in a part of the church. You just tried to bring that in. That's very difficult to do musically and whatever. Before I continue, your response to this wave of data. What is your initial response to difference? Are you afraid of it? Has your church welcomed it? Do you not think about it?
Well, my experience has been, like, about 3 years ago, I lifted up that flag because our neighborhood is changing over. Like someone else had mentioned earlier, we were in Miami, when we say African American, we were more like our descendants were from Georgia,
right?
That kind of thing, not to be confused with, you know, people of Caribbean descent, because there was some cultural things there. We were doing pretty good along those lines, but then Mexicans started moving into the neighborhood, and like I was saying, you know, it's going to be time for us to start looking at, you know, this particular population that's coming in,
right?
And you know, just from a fiscal budget, you know, vacation Bible school, mm-hmm. Ministry outreach, you know, do we need to be, you know, bilingual when we do our street ministries and things like that? How much do we need to know? So it's like it's like, you know, it's a process. You keep have to, you know, I'm having to say it over,
yes,
and over and, yes, over and over again, and then, you know, it's gradually beginning to take some
Bravo that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Because quite honestly, if we don't find a way, guys, just think of something. This is a worship institute. Think what it must be like to worship in someone else's language. See, this is why we can't ignore this. To ignore this is to say, we demand that you become us before you worship the Lord that we serve. We demand that you, if you're Korean, you learn Farsi before you can understand the story. That's just wrong. That's just not right. Now,
I wanted to share with the, like in Atlanta, the Presbyterian, a wonderful thing happened. The Koreans came to the African American community, the Korean Presbyterians, because at the time of the Rodney King, they wanted to kind of build a relationship. And from that time to now, every Christmas we have this multicultural we've just experienced. And we sang the Hallelujah Chorus in all languages. It's grown to where there are some Taiwanese, and there are some Latino. And so it was every language, and it was most moving. Most moving.
Well, to me, your story, a dramatic story, reminds me of a story that our president talks about in the book. I didn't bring any copies, I should have. It's called Out of Ashes by Dr. Keith Phillips. It's his rendition after the Watts riots and what happened, the latest L.A. riots. A lot of the leaders in L.A., Hayford level leaders in Los Angeles, all got together and had this rally. And one of the Young Knock Presbyterian Church decided that it would participate. This is a Korean church. Many first-generation Koreans are part of this church, a huge church, a mega church. They brought a big 400-member choir with robes and everything, set up in the park in downtown L.A. and sang in impeccable Spanish this song. So look at L.A. Here's a Korean choir that knows Spanish so well that they can come down and participate in a multicultural outreach. This is the world we're in now. It's fruit basket upset, quite literally. It's wonderful. We know culture. I gave you my definition of it. It's that integrated, well-established, community-defined patterns of behavior worldview that influences the way we think, the way we feel, and the way we act. Learned patterns, worldview, and then these dimensions. Now, there is the complexity of difference. It's on page 168 of your, and this is my own crude sort of thinking. Race is less and less a viable scientific concept. And you find many, many people talking now about phenotypical differences. You know, class and culture are a little easier, but it's the integration of all of this that makes difference so complex and so difficult. Our world is mind-bogglingly diverse. And the barriers are formidable. There are all of these gaps at every level in socioeconomic equality, the way our kinship patterns are governed, our levels of technological sophistication, our own ethical visions of the human good, and then now add on top of that all of these modern dragons, spirituality without God, which has really affected a host of the urban cultures that I'm aware of. Again, the cognitive, the effective, and the evaluative dimensions. Cognitive is the knowledge shared by members of a group. I love Hebert's definition on that. The effective dimension are the feelings, the way we think about things, and the evaluative dimension. Guys, this is something that if I can do an experiment, I hope you guys won't bother. I am at a safe presenting distance. This is fine for the Institute of Worship Studies and everything else. I'll play a prank on Ken. He's the only person who won't sock me in the head. And I apologize, video camera. If I were to deliver the rest of my presentation from this close to Ken, this close. Now, we know, Ken and I, thank you, dear brother. You're such a, we have never had any discussion. Yeah, we have never had a discussion about the legitimacy of where presence is. But quite honestly, it may not be spoken, but there are things you cannot do. That's the way culture is. Nobody taught you social distance. You didn't take a class on that. There are thousands of things you take for granted. That quite honestly, and this is what makes it so hard. This is very hard. Flicking your left ear, showing your foot to someone, you know, shaking left hands with someone. There are dozens of things you do not do if you don't understand. That's what makes this all the more difficult. Behavior and products and the way we believe. 167. I'm going to give you a crash course in urban culture. See sub 1, sub 2, and sub 3 culture. Just real quickly, an instrument that we use to help people sort of understand the complexity of the difference. Let's say, and I don't use this in a pejorative way, let's say the majority of culture in America is white, Anglo-Saxon, and Protestant. We know that it's really fairly neo-pagan. Very few people actually are part of the church in America now. So that really is sort of a misnomer now. But for the sake of what we're doing, it allows me to talk about it. Now, if you can see this circle, if this circle represents white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant culture, the mainstream culture, its values, its learned patterns, its kinship and family habits, all of that, you can see from this illustration that there are now so-called racial groups that really intersect with this main culture. Can you see that? You can see that from your diagram, too. I'll pick on myself with black. C3 black. If C3 culture, just let me choose three indicators, where you live, where you're educated, and where you work. A C3 black will work downtown Jacksonville. Maybe he was educated at Florida State in business school, and he works downtown for a big company. And all his friends and everyone with him, his cultural makeup is mainstream white makeup. He is black in phenotype, but his culture is mainstream. Do you understand what I'm saying? He was educated in the white world. He lives in the white world. He works in a white world. He is, for all intents, it doesn't mean that he's an Uncle Tom or an Oreo. That's not what I'm saying. It's just if he talks about black power, he's not going to do it from the ghetto when he talks about it. The point is that I'll put myself in the C2 category. From years of bicultural relations with people in some of the hardest ghettos, and having to write really nice praises and good adept papers in the academy, I am a bicultural brother. I can give high fives, or I can do what I need to do. I can relate depending on the need where I'm at. Frankly, bicultural people are some of the most versatile people, culture. They understand culture and they know how to react to a person just by gauging them. They know whether or not, you know, they can feel, I feel totally at home, y'all, in the city. You drop me off downtown and, you know, I can get around. I can read situations. I'm not going to get hurt. I'm not going to take chances. I know that world. I grew up in that world. I was born in that world. But I can also hopefully give a semi-interesting on-time lecture at the worship center. A C1 black is a person who is black but has no contact whatsoever with the white world. None. There are people 30 minutes from this building might as well live 1,500 miles away. They have nothing to do. There's not a single cultural marker in this room. They've never gone to church. They are neo-pagan in every way. They have no relationship with anything. They wouldn't know Moses from Abraham, from Augustine, from nothing. They are completely on the outside. What now? I've given you enough, and I've sort of arranged this that for whites, Asians, blacks, and Hispanics, we have looked at very similar reactions. That these groups, oftentimes, I'll just put poor white out there, they the way they respond to the mainstream culture is the way they actually are. They view themselves in relationship to the mainstream. What are the possibilities? Tell me. Will a C1 black relate better to a C3 black or a C1 Asian or white or Hispanic? Bill Cosby is not going to go down to hood and everybody's going to view him favorably. Right? We used to think that black is black, right? There are black churches. They're black churches. Black churches can serve as black churches. Asian churches can serve as Asian churches. Worship styles and Hispanic churches, even Hispanics, they can take care of the Hispanics. Let's make a deal. Hispanics take care of Hispanics. Blacks take care of blacks. What is wrong with that thinking, just based on this?
They don't interrelate at all.
They don't interrelate at all. Guys, where are our Christian educational institutions on this matter?
C3.
They're C3 categorically. What students do they recruit to bring to their places?
C3.
Where do those students go to do their ministry?
C3.
Who trains C1? Who trains C1 worship leaders anywhere? Our only answer for C1, I'm talking about street folk. Now, this is really important because I'd love to see that. I'm pretty much in the know. I know what Potter's House is doing.
Oh, really?
But yeah, but it's, and I know, I mean, the great guys. I mean, Tony Evans, I presented with Tony Evans. He's a great guy. I like these guys. But I'm telling you, C1 guys, do-rag guys, dudes in the city guys, hip-hop guys, these people are completely oblivious. There are 50 million C1s of all various colors in America. 50 million. Now, I'm saying that we could have 100 seminars like this and not touch any of the C1 population.
That's where their gangs come in.
You're exactly right. The Latin Kings, 18,000 people. I'm saying these guys exist. I want the story for them. See, that's one of the, this is on the story. I want the story for them. I'm not going to let them go. So, okay, guys, you are my board. Tell me how to win the C1s for Christ. Guys, I'm saying that this population is dramatically big, and it's going nowhere, and we are not training a single person. Just think about this. It will take us, the average debt of a seminarian is somewhere between 50,
Amen.
45 to 50K in debt.
Yes.
How can you go owing $50,000 to a little C1 church of 27 people, which on a good Sunday gets $28.33 in the pot? That's really going to service my debt, right? So everything in this is built so we don't mess with those people. If they would just stay out there, we'll be fine. If we can just keep them away from us and not deal with them. Well, it is not as gloomy as it looks. But again, the story of God. Frankly, guys, this would matter to me if I didn't really want in my heart to reach as many people as I possibly can. Turn to page 171 in your book. If you look at your diagram, we essentially have churches that service people who are like us and who are ethnocentrically fine with us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the squares go to the square church, triangles go to the triangle church, and of course the circles go to the circles church.
Mm-hmm.
And you see all of these people who live right real close. They're neither squares, triangles or circles, or squigglies and stars, but they live right next door to our church. Now, our congregations are largely homogenous, and we do outreach with people like them in our church, which leaves this huge gap of people who have no church and no way to integrate them. We will say, we have a triangle in our church. Haven't you ever been in a church like that? Yeah, we had some. We sure did. We have one.
That's my church. And
right.
Racism and cultural bias is an issue at my church, and the people use that as an excuse to say, well, we have this person or these people, and like you said, they're the token member. How do you move beyond that to get people to acknowledge the problem and see what's...
That's right. Guys, it is, language is one of these indicators. If the Institute does not address these issues directly, it will only service congregations, essentially, that are of people like them. And as fine as that is not the evangelical mandate, is that we tell these folk the stories and then get them into the church too.
Mm-hmm.
That's the evangelical mandate. Let's bring them all in. I don't want any of them left out. I want them all in. I am convinced that ingredient in the story that God has given us is everything that we need to acknowledge the differences between people and to overcome those differences in very creative ways for the gospel's sake. Quite honestly, I'm a person that tolerates absolutely not one scintilla of racism in my presence. If I think you are that way, I'm going after you, because these are people that belong to me. I don't tolerate it at all under any circumstances. I believe in the communion of saints. I don't just say it. I believe it. It means that we are one. It means that I must do everything I can at every level to honor what I believe our God is doing. It's a core component of our understanding of the story. And so I think that there are a lot of different ways that we can do this. I know I have friends who have started the congregations share mutually. They have mutual services and things like this. Some of my best friend, one of the past chaplains at Wheaton, a dear brother, a friend of mine, he has a church, and he has both Asian and Hmong and other congregations all meet at the same time. They have services and they work out languages. They don't pretend that if I don't know your language, they don't pretend that you can do a liturgy for me. Yeah. Let's not pretend that. If you don't know my language, if you don't understand who I am, don't pretend to be me. You're not
That's
me.
Right. Right.
Don't just impose what you think is good on me.
Yes.
That's not right. That's not sufficient. You can accept me as a brother and a sister in this one story, and I take my place and we work this out. It's bloody, messy, there's a lot of speed bumps and humps, but we will churn our way through for the sake of the kingdom. To me, this is why the story, and I will say that why Bob was so key for me. Bob gave me a way to handle culture in a biblical way, to take it with full force. Guys, you can tell from my analysis, and this is one of dozens that we have done, I do not take culture lightly. Don't pretend that if just because we're the same skin color don't mean that we can relate culturally. Mm-hmm. Don't pretend that you can relate to people who are even white. Dear friends, you have no idea. Difference in the city has taught me to be humble when it comes to it. But when Christ enters into the heart of a person, he can transform them for good, and I bank on that good. I demand that good. I am telling you guys right now that anyone who accepts Christ, I absolutely demand that they live by the unity of the faith. I have no relationship with someone. If you say you know Christ and you don't love his people, there's a fissure in who you are, regardless of how pristine your liturgies are. There's something wrong with you. Something is dying in you, decaying in you, if you don't love those who belong to you. You share the same sperma, is the word that John used in 1 John. Sperma is the Greek term. We are from the same DNA. The sperma of God remains in us. That's pretty powerful. God gave birth to y'all. How on earth can I say I love God and not love you? This whole thing for me is the issue on whether or not your worship is legit. Did you know that there were people who lynched black Christians in the morning and went to church picnics in the evening in the South? I'm saying, guys, they had everything right in one way and everything wrong in another. I'm saying that if we really begin to wrestle with this, this is the problem, by the way, for urban churches. What do black churches do when they are inundated with populations around them that are from Laos, Cambodia, and from Central America? I mean, what are they supposed to do? Are our staff supposed to learn languages? How do we respond to that? This is the new worship reality for American churches. And frankly, I think there are some really great ideas that we can handle this. But it's not for the squeamish and not for the domesticated. Theodore Roosevelt Davis, he was named during that time when blacks used to name their kids after presidents because they wanted to show people that we're patriotic. We want to just participate. Theodore Roosevelt went to World War II. He fought in World War II. One of the few images I have of my dad is him standing on some bricks in Rome. He came back. The GI Bill didn't apply to him.
No,
it didn't. It didn't. He couldn't participate in any. He couldn't go to schools. This generation is still, these are the guys who are still plastering those churches. They have a memory. So if we go into them, we have to have some way, See, just imagine if we got scholarships for 40 C1 guys, men and women. What percentage of the curriculum, the lectures, the acknowledgement, the experience is going to be C1? What percentage?
Not very small.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying that so the burden is on these people. This is one of the reasons why, quite honestly, in every Christian consortium school you see, there's a little group of angry blacks who are just mad at the world, or browns or whatever. Because really, frankly, they've come in by scholarship, and people don't understand culture. They don't really realize that culture matters. Difference makes a difference. There are no half-hearted measures that's going to make this real. I'd much rather us say we have real cultural differences. Some of the interesting things that take place here are this direction. C1s on C1s. Guys, World Impact, to me, believes that you do not have to become C3 in order to become a leader. Yeah. Now think of this equation. You do not have to become C3.
Yeah.
That is my whole job. We don't. With all due respect to the Institute or anybody else, they don't have to go through there and learn what you know in order to be God's person.
That's right.
Who said that? Where is that in the story? That's not in the story.
That's not in the story.
So what we can do, in fact, this is what I'm interested in. How can I train a generation of people who will nurture those 50 million that we're not integrating in our churches, who are sort of on their own? What if the Holy Spirit were to fall on 30 million hip-hop kids in America? What would we do with them? How would we change our... Are we open to changing our liturgies to include their culture? This, by the way, Ken, is why Bob is so... He was so well out into the future. I mean, he talked about the story and in building a sense of unity. This is exactly how I can do it. Mm-hmm. The story of God is the way we can do it. I will embrace C1 forms of art and the way that the liturgies that are being done. I mean, I'm just giving you a handful. There are acres and acres of stuff being done by people who serve in C1s. They're coming up with their own things. They're informed by history, but they're not tied to it. They're their own people.
But the struggle is, as a C2,
yeah,
who's dealing with C1 to the point of being almost drowned.
Right.
That's the situation I find myself
yes.
in.
Yes.
Because I'm teaching at the graduate level, working with ghetto ministry, with that $50,000 plus a point of debt,
yes,
and spending
amazing.
All my money on my ministry.
That's amazing.
Now, how do you maintain that balance without losing your sanity?
Well, I'll just be honest. Guys, the only hope, this is, if everyone were in attendance, I would have said the only hope is for us to frankly experiment in seeing a C1 church formed in America that can serve a C1 form. I think it's not, I took 20 hours a semester, my wife babysat. I was an associate pastor, I taught on the faculty of Wheaton, and that was 20 years ago just to make ends meet. I mean, it's impossible. What I'm saying is that with all due respect, it's impossible to matriculate a person up this way and then back this way.
Yeah.
It's just, it's too expensive. Who can carry this debt load? That ensures that they'll never minister among the poor. How can they?
Yeah.
It's just not fair to them to ask them to go back. So we essentially created curriculum, liturgy, teaching, spiritual formation, small group materials, everything for C1 people. We give it away. You know, friends, if a person at the Institute can't afford what we do, if a student couldn't afford our textbooks, we would lease them the textbooks. If they didn't have enough money to lease the textbooks, we would frankly, as a staff, we would raise the money and give it to them. If they cannot, if our students can't afford curriculum, we'd never turn a person down. We have graduated, I bet nearly, we've graduated a lot of people in our whole network, but now none of them are in debt. And many of them have gone on to plant churches in C1 communities. I mean, in other words, they don't owe a penny,
Is it accurate, Don, that a trained C1 leader will more effectively reach C1 churches than a trained C3 leader?
Yes, without equivocation. There's no... The real issue is, what is the likelihood that if I was C1, I could come to the Institute of Worship Studies and be trained to minister among the urban poor? So that I could help them form liturgies.
Are you also saying it is somewhat of a misnomer, then, for us just to say, let these C1 churches just expand the borders and just bring C1 and C2s in?
I think that's virtually impossible to do. I have no compunction in asking C2s to look this. They're bicultural. Right. They can continue to speak. They can speak this language. Oftentimes their mother lives there.
Yeah.
Their friends live there. Right. They know this community. They grew up there. They know. When I graduated, the year I graduated with my PhD, I looked at the longitudinal data. There were 40,000 PhDs conferred the year of my graduation. And they measured this in terms of decades. And so there were 40,000 degrees conferred over that decade in America of PhDs, roughly. Did you know that there were barely 250 blacks in all fields who received advanced degrees during that time? 250 black men. I was one of six guys over a 10-year period who got their PhD from a Division I school. Why on earth, when Emory and all these places are giving me free rides and I've been offered work at Princeton, and why would I go back? All my friends say, man, you're crazy. What are you doing going back? And the answer is the story. The story has brought me back. The story is magnificent. The story is important. I'm not going to just leave them, frankly. I'm going to go back, do what I can. We're nonprofit for sure, is what I'm saying. We don't take any money. I'll give it away. I raise money for everything that I do. Money is of no concern to me. I'm just trying to do right by the kingdom and by Christ and by those who are least able to pay me back. Isn't that what Jesus said? He said, you throw a banquet, call the people who can't pay you back.
That's
Isn't that what he said? I'm just trying to do that.